the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Now, you might be thinking, and you should be, what is he doing up there standing talking about science? Well, all sorts of people who've got a scientific education. But the place is full of scientists. What am I doing here? Well, I trust if I get any of my scientific facts wrong tonight, somebody stand up and shout, heresy! Or something like that. But I'm going to be as simple as I possibly can. My interest in this subject is a different one. I work a lot because of the kind of conversations I've just described with you on the interface of science and faith. Very few weeks go by, if one, where I'm not answering some kind of scientific question about faith. And I guess in the world in which we live, you and I are going to encounter that kind of reaction more and more, aren't we? I'd like to believe what you do, but I can't because of science. In a sense, we're back, I suppose, in the situation against which that chapter we've heard read tonight was written. A situation in which what Christians believe seems laughable to the rest of the world. And Paul says to the Corinthians, don't worry, God has chosen the foolish things of this world to confound the wise. Those people who think they have it all sorted out, who have a watertight system that God cannot break into, they're wrong. And you will see just how wrong. And of course, within a couple of hundred years after that, the world was starting to see just how wrong the world had been to dismiss Christianity. And Christians won. It wasn't just that they won in terms of numbers, with the number of people who got converted. It wasn't just that they won politically in the fact that Christianity became the state religion of the biggest empire in the world. They won academically and intellectually as well. And the thinkers of the 3rd and 4th century who were best and most profound were working in a Christian frame of reference. And they found no difficulty now in making science and current knowledge and philosophy and all of the other things that people were talking about relate to Christian faith. Far from being a little fringy thing on the outside, suddenly it seemed at the centre of everything. And so we're asking the question tonight, who's right? Are the Jesses of this world right to say, I'd believe, but science makes it impossible? Or is there a way in which science and Christianity can illumine one another and fit together as parts of the same worldview? Why is there a problem in our age between science and Christianity anyhow? Well, there's a very interesting website called biologos.com, put up by Francis Collins, of whom I'll say a bit earlier, which is a kind of meeting point for good, thoughtful papers put together by theologians, scientists, and other thinkers to just think about some of the interactions of science and Christianity. And one paper on that site made what I thought was a very good point. It said, listen, there will always be the possibility of conflict between science and the Bible, because the Bible always needs to be interpreted. The Bible always needs us to say, what does this actually mean? And sometimes things that we thought we saw clearly in the Bible, like slavery, for instance, a few hundred years ago, are not really there when you look. Like the idea that the earth does not move. The idea that the earth is the center of the universe. All of those things were thought to be biblical at one stage, and the Bible needs interpretation. On the other hand, science changes. Science changes because what science is basically a bunch of theories. And a theory is something which explains the facts as best we can at this present moment. But the tragedy of science, as one great scientist once put it, is a beautiful theory slain by an ugly fact. And that happens again and again. That again and again in the history of science, you think you've got something that explains all of the evidence. Then you find one little bit of evidence that just doesn't fit. And it may explode a beautiful theory. I was telling one of my upper fifth groups this week about René Blondlot. Has anybody heard of René Blondlot? Ah, I thought not. Very famous French scientist in the 19th century. Because he was the discoverer of N-rays. Anybody heard of N-rays? No, I thought not. Because they were completely and totally bogus. They seemed to explain the facts. He was given academic awards. He was given external degrees, all sorts of things, because of his amazing breakthrough discovery. And then they found it didn't actually fit with the evidence from the real world, and so the theory had to change. And so science changes. Our interpretation of Scripture is always the best that we can do. And so from time to time, there is going to seem to be a conflict between science and Scripture. That needn't worry us. The important thing is just to look at it honestly and clearly and try to work it out. Why do people sense there is a conflict between science and Christianity? I guess it's because of the way in which science has changed our view of the world dramatically in the last few centuries. Let's put the first slide up if we can and just have a look at this. The story starts with a man called Claudius Ptolemy, background about AD 150. And he was working in Alexandria in Egypt, in one of those academies that became famous, the great centres of Christian thinking. Ptolemy himself was an astronomer, and he had a view of the way in which the universe worked, which put the Earth right at the centre of the system, with everything else revolving around it in perfect circles. And that view of the way the universe was made a lot of sense to Christians. Because after all, if human beings are the crown of God's creation, we should be somewhere at the middle of things, shouldn't we? And so for the Earth to be at the centre of everything, with everything else revolving around it, that made perfect sense. And so Ptolemy's theory held sway until, well, I guess the 15th century. And then along comes a man called Nicolaus Copernicus, a Polish academic and monk from the University of Torun. And Copernicus developed a different view of the universe, which you can see there. It was a heliocentric view. The sun was at the centre. Where is the Earth? Just going around the Earth like around the sun, like every other planet. And Copernicus never encountered any scorn because of his theory, because fortunately he died the day his book came out. He suffered from apoplexy at the age of 70, just as the book was going through the press, and he revived sufficiently to hold a copy of the book in his hands and say, ah, good, and then he died. So he never had to live with the outcome of his theories, but of course, other people did. Johannes Kepler, a great German scientist of the 17th century, took it forward a bit when he said, yes, he was right, and what's more, Ptolemy was wrong to say that the planets go around in circles, they go around in ellipses instead. And Kepler was somebody who believed strongly that although the Earth was no longer at the centre of everything, that didn't matter because what we were doing was discovering what God was all about. He's the man who made the famous quotation that science is simply exploring, thinking God's thoughts after him, which is a great way to put it. And Kepler said, the diversity of the phenomena of nature is so great and the treasures hidden in the heavens so rich, precisely in order that the human mind shall never be lacking in fresh nourishment. And he saw the hand of God and God's stimulation to intellectual activity all over the place. He did not believe that what we were discovering about the universe threw God into any doubt whatsoever. But of course, Galileo came into conflict for these very ideas with the Inquisition. Now, it's got to be said that Galileo wasn't the most sensitive or tactful of scientists. And in some ways, he had it coming. But let's face it, that ever since he appeared before the Inquisition, there has been an impression in people's minds down through the centuries that on the one hand you've got the church hanging on to obscurantism and the way it's always been, and on the other hand you have the brave, courageous scientists moving forward, trying to explore truth by themselves, and the church is just holding them back. Galileo, though, was a Christian. He was somebody who believed in God very, very strongly. And he said this, I do not feel obliged to believe that the same God who has endowed us with sense, reason, and intellect has intended us to forego their use. He believed that we live in a world which has regularity about it because God made it that way. God is a faithful God. He makes a universe that runs by rules. And so we can discover those rules. And God intends us to do that. And at his trial, he appealed to those expert witnesses, other astronomers who'd been called in to argue against him. Just look through my telescope. If you look through my telescope, you will see that the heavens are as I say they are. And they said, we don't need to look through your telescope. We know already your telescope's enchanted. It's satanic. It's demonic. So we're not going to look. And that was the antithesis of Galileo's point of view. God has put real information out there for us to look at. We just have to make sense of it. But the whole picture was changing. And when you get to Sir Isaac Newton in the 18th century, things change once again. Now again, you're talking about a man here with a profound and deep faith in God. Didn't go to church an awful lot, but he really believed in God and talked an awful lot about it, and probably did more theological calculation than he did scientific calculation. But what he did was, of course, absolutely mind-bending, because the discoveries of Newton put all of this on a firm basis. All of the things that all of these other guys had observed, Newton explained in terms of regular principles. He assumed that gravity was the same, operated in the same way throughout the whole universe. And therefore, if something happened on Earth, you could predict the way it was going to happen out there in the heavens. And it was just mind-blowing for his generation to think the same principles that govern the fall of an apple from a tree govern the way and the speed and the rate and the distance at which planets circle around the sun. And for the first time, Newton seemed to have explained a mechanism that fitted it all together. And of course, the outcome of that was that scientists started saying, well, where's God? Do we need God anymore? If we have a mechanism by which it all works, a great clockwork machine, then clearly God is not necessary. And when the equally great Laplace brought his book to Napoleon to present to him about his extension of Newton's ideas, Napoleon said, very, very interesting, and where is God in your picture of things? And Laplace said famously, sire, I have had no need of that hypothesis. And that was God, down to just being a hypothesis. An unnecessary hypothesis, something that just belongs on the edge of things but isn't really part of the picture anymore. Well, Newton's discoveries led in several directions, which were not all good. One of the things that happened was a movement called deism. And deism was the movement that said, well, you can see in the regularity of the earth and the way in which the system works and its total unfailing reliability, it must have been designed by somebody. But we can't believe in miracles. We can't believe in a relationship with God. We can't believe in talking to God and getting an answer. So what we believe is that God created everything, wound it up like a gigantic watch, and then went away, and he's doing something different. Perhaps he's inventing new universes somewhere else. Nobody knows. Miracles, you know, a tea break or whatever. But he's not around any longer. And so deism said the only way that you can see God today is through the massive system that he's created. That is not what Christians believe. Christians don't look for evidence of God in just the regularities of nature. And ultimately, the proof of God cannot just be the incredible way in which the whole universe has been formed and brought together, although you can say an awful lot about the tremendous chances that are involved in the emergence of human life and so on and so forth. But that's not a Christian view. And nor is nothing buttery. This is another idea that came out of Newton's discoveries, I guess. The polite name for this is ontological reductionism. What it means is you say that something is nothing but something else. You see, people started to believe that if we had a mechanism that explained how the universe worked, we didn't need God any longer. He wasn't necessary to bring into it because now we saw how everything fitted together. But you know, there can be more than one level of explanation for something. You see somebody running up Sidwell Street this morning, and you say, why is that person running? Well, you can explain it in terms of biology. You can explain it in terms of the physics of locomotion. You can explain it in terms of the fact that it's the Great West Run, and this is what they do every time this year, 3,000 of them. You can explain it in terms of this guy's running to raise money for the hospice or whatever it happens to be. They're all different levels of explanation, and they do not cancel one another out. So to say the planets circle the sun because of what we've discovered about gravity and the way things were created in the first place is not necessarily to say that God is ruled out of the picture. There can be more than one way of looking at things, and nothing buttery saying it is nothing but a system in which we don't need God is the wrong way to look at it. And the third thing, I suppose, is God of the gaps thinking. And this is the believers fighting back, saying, ah, well, they've explained this, but they haven't explained this yet. They haven't explained that they've explained this, but they haven't explained that yet. My old mum always used to say, well, you know, there's one thing that scientists will never do, and that is they will never invent life. Well, they're getting pretty close to it, depending on your definition of life. And the trouble with the God of the gaps is that God is somebody you bring in to explain all the gaps. They can do this, but they will never do that. And then they do it. Okay, they'll never do this then. And see, every time a gap is filled in, your God gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And that, again, is not a biblical view of God. A God who simply fills in the gaps that science can't explain yet. No, the Bible's view of God is that God is there in the whole system all the time. But you can't detect him at the scientific kind of a level. There's a great book, written by John Wright, the nuclear physicist, called Designer Universe, in which he says, if you think of a game of chess, that helps to explain how Christians see this thing. He says, it's an analogy that must not be taken too far, but it's helpful. If some intelligent observer who had never heard of chess was shown a number of games being played, he'd be able to deduce the basic rules. He'd rapidly discover that pawns moved up the board, bishops moved diagonally, and so on. But being intelligent, he would deduce that there was more to it than merely a set of rules. There was a purpose in the game, to capture the opposing king, and the strategies involved in the process were very complex and subtle. The basic rules were simple and never violated, and yet there was sufficient openness or freedom that a sophisticated and intellectually challenging game was possible. And the essence of the game is to be found in the battle that is raging rather than merely in the rules alone, although they are never violated. He says, now, look again at God's interaction with his universe. There are rules. We observe them as the laws of physics, laws which we now know contain enough flexibility for subtle and complex interactions to be feasible. Moreover, in spite of some difficult philosophical problems, most people would accept the common sense view that we possess free will. The future is determined at least in part by our own personal decisions. And if we can influence the world, how much more God? He upholds and sustains it. But just as the players in the game of chess influence the shape of the game without breaking the basic rules, so God works in his universe without, normally, going against his laws of science. Christians can look at the universe from a scientific perspective, using all the powerful tools modern science makes available to them, and find a beautiful and subtle pattern. But they can, with equal validity, examine the world with the eye of faith and discover meaning and purpose. They believe God has a plan for their lives and discover this as it unfolds. They find themselves presented with opportunities to serve God and to help others that seem to have arisen by more than mere coincidence. They discover a hidden power available within themselves when faced with situations that they would have thought were beyond them. So there are two ways, two explanations, two levels, and both are equally valid. Well, since then, things have got a little bit complicated, and that deterministic view of the universe has had to disappear to some extent. There's been chaos theory, there's been relativity. I'm not about to try to explain them in 30 seconds, I get it all wrong anyway. And there's quantum theory. The discovery, basically, that at the atomic level and the subatomic level, things don't behave quite as predictably as Newton thought they did. Above that level, everything behaves according to very easy, understandable rules. Below that level, there's chance and there's uncertainty. That's led some people to go off in the opposite direction and say, oh, well, instead of having a universe that's predictable in which we know the rules and therefore we don't need God, now we have a universe which is a total mess. Total chaos. Jacques Monod, for instance, who was a Nobel Prize winner for biology, along with a couple of other people, wrote a book called Chance and Necessity back in the 1970s, which was very, very powerful. And he said, these discoveries show that there is nothing in charge of the universe. It's all based on randomness, on chance. Pure chance, absolutely free but blind, is at the very root of the stupendous edifice of evolution. Man at last knows that he is alone in the unfeeling immensity of the universe, out of which he emerged by chance. Neither his destiny nor his duty have been written down. But as people have been pointing out ever since, he's talking about things that happen at the subatomic level. And for most of normal life, chance and necessity don't rule the roost in the same way that they do at that level. We're in a universe which is a mixture of randomness and rules. And it's perfectly possible that there is a creator who is in charge of the whole process. So that's where modern science is taken. So let me just answer four questions in the 10 minutes we have left to try to fill in why I think the Christians are still right. First of all, you've got to ask the question, what kind of God is it that Christians believe in? Because we don't believe in a watchmaker God who started it all off and can be detected in the beauty of what he's made. We don't believe in a God of the gaps. We don't believe in many of the kinds of God that people like Richard Dawkins talk about. The second question I want to look at is, what sort of universe is this? What do we gain from looking at the universe? Third, where do human beings fit in? Because we've not talked about Darwin or evolution or anything like that yet. What about that? What do we think about ourselves in all of this? And then fourth, very, very quickly at the end, does science push people away from Christian faith? Let's look at those four questions. First of all, what kind of God do Christians believe in? Richard Dawkins calls him one of the most unpleasant characters in the whole of fiction. Is that exactly right, though? Is the God of the Bible somebody who can be held responsible for everything that happens in the universe when you want him to be, or somebody who seems irrelevant to the process equally when you want him to be? Christians would say no. The God of creation is behind everything that happens. He works through the scientific laws, not instead of them, not in spite of them. And the God that we believe in is not a God of the gaps. But anyway, I've said a good deal about this. Let's move on to the second question. What sort of universe is this that we're living in? There are some things that we've found out, I think, about our universe through all of this process of scientific discovery, which are important for us to bear in mind. The first thing is, it's a vast universe with one very special planet. As far as we know, this is the only planet where the conditions for human life have emerged, and the chances of them emerging in that way are absolutely infinitesimally small. How is it possible that the chances of life came together as they did on this planet and nowhere else? Is there anywhere else? Well, we don't know. We've only just started discovering planets around other stars, so we don't know too much about other planets in our galaxy, let alone in the others. And there are some attempts, there's a famous Green Bank formula which tries to predict how many planets there will be in the universe on which there might be intelligent life. The Green Bank formula comes up with 50,000, but it's pure and total guesswork. There's one factor in that calculation, which is the length of time during which you can expect a civilization to be able to communicate with other civilizations. And we've only been able to do that over the last few years. Who knows how long we'll be able to do it? And we're arguing from one case ourselves. We don't have a range of examples to put together, so nobody really knows. And as far as it stands at the moment, we are the only planet on which this incredible miracle of life has taken place. And when you look at the chances that are stacked against it, scientists talk about the anthropic principle. The idea that conditions in the universe were favourable to the emergence of human life. Why was that? Was that pure blind coincidence? Or was it because somebody was making it happen? And is the whole story of the universe about making that possibility happen because God was reaching out to people made in his image with whom he wanted to have a relationship? Sir Bernard Lovell, the famous astronomer, once said, "Is the universe as it is because it was necessary for the emergence of human beings?" And Sir Frederick Hoyle, one of the greatest physicists of the 20th century, said this: "I do not believe that any scientist who examined the evidence would fail to draw the inference that the laws of nuclear physics have been deliberately designed with regard to the consequences they produce inside the stars." I heard Hoyle being interviewed on Radio 4 shortly before his death. And this is a man who'd lived all of his life as an atheist and a skeptic as far as Christianity was concerned. He'd given some Christians a very hard time indeed. And he was saying on this program, "I now believe, as a result of my researches, that there is some kind of mind behind the universe. The way in which it all fits together could not have been chance. There must have been some sort of planning mind." And the interviewer asked him the obvious question: "Does this mean, Professor Hoyle, that you now believe in God?" And it was a really interesting 2 minutes of radio, because he coughed and spluttered. Well, God, when you use that, I mean, you have to define your terms. I mean, God, well, God. And he was straining every nerve to say, "No, I don't." But he was forced by the evidence to admit that that was where his research was pushing him. So we live in a world in which there's plenty of evidence, if you look for it, that something very, very special indeed is going on. We're also living in a universe where randomness and rules coexist. It's not the Newtonian universe where there's an explanation for everything and none of it involves God. We now know that the universe is a much more mysterious place than we imagined, and much as we're discovering, there's plenty of room for the existence of a God who creates and is involved in the system, in the chess game analogy that we saw. Third, it's a universe where we're both participants and observers, and that's important too. It's not as if we're standing outside looking at the universe and saying, okay, right, now what do we make of this? We are involved in the process. We are part of what is going on, and that makes it much more difficult for us, from our standpoint, to work out clearly what is actually taking place. And all of this is important stuff about our universe. One of the more important things, too, is that we live in a universe where the ought doesn't come from the is. What do I mean by that? Well, that's a phrase that was used by the philosopher Anthony Flew several years ago, when he said, you know, we live in a universe where it's possible to work out the is with more and more clarity. We can study what is around us. We can find out how the universe works. But none of that gives us a steer on how we ought to live our lives. You cannot, he said, derive the ought from the is. Where do we get our morality from? Where do we get our sense of purpose from? How do we know how we ought to spend our lives? How we ought to build a society? How we ought to relate to one another? And Flew said, we need something more than the universe provides us with. And so we live ultimately in a universe which has plenty of signposts pointing towards our need for someone to tell us how to live these wonderful lives that we've got. And that's where God comes in. Stephen Hawking, who spent most of his life in the pursuit of a unified theory that will hold the whole bundle of observations that we know together, says this: even if there is only one possible unified theory, it's just a set of rules and equations. What is it that breathes fire into the equations and makes a universe for them to describe? The usual approach of science of constructing a mathematical model cannot answer the question of why there should be a universe for the model to describe. And back a few years ago, there was a really interesting headline article in the New York Times headed, "Have Astronomers Found God?" And it was written by Robert Jastrow, who at that point was a leading scientist, the head of the Goddard Space Science Laboratory in America. And he said, you know, we've studied everything we can as far back to the first microsecond of the Big Bang. And we know everything that happened beyond that point. But you reach a point beyond which you cannot go. And something started. Why did it start? We don't know. We just know that something must have got it going. And he said, for the scientist who has lived his life by faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the rocks of ignorance, and as he pulls himself up towards the final summit, he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries. Great quote. And Jastrow said, I'm not a Christian, but I've got to admit there is somebody or there is something that says why there is something rather than nothing, and without God, I'm helpless to explain that. The third question we wanted to ask was simply this: where do human beings fit into all of this? What do we believe about human beings? And obviously, since this man's work in the 19th century, there has been tremendous debate about where human beings fit in the whole thing. And this has become a really heated debate between Christians and of different sorts and non-Christians over the last few years. I think unnecessarily so. But I don't want to take sides on the creation-evolution debate. All I will say is this, that whichever you believe, there are ways that are perfectly intellectually honourable of squaring it with Scripture. It's not that the Bible tells us something that science has now disproved. The question's not really a scientific one. It's a literary one. How do you read the Bible? What is the Bible saying? Are Genesis 1 and 2 to be taken as a scientific account of the world's origins and the origins of human beings? Or are they doing something different? If you look back through Christian and Jewish interpretation, you'll find that right down through the centuries, up to the 19th century, there were plenty of people saying, this cannot be a literal description. This is allegorical. This is a story to describe something else. It's not supposed to be science. And it's only in the 19th century that they find people starting to take sides. And in their own day, arguments between creationism and evolution taken to a bitter legal level, and all of the stuff that's gone on since. But it seems to me that if Genesis 1 and 2 are supposed to be a scientific account, were supposed to be a scientific account, they wouldn't have been very helpful to people down through the centuries. I mean, can you imagine if Genesis was written in modern scientific language, how I created the world by God, a cosmological treatise, how would people have understood the vocabulary and the concepts before now? You can see all these 15th century monks in the monasteries looking at the manuscripts and asking one another, well, what's a molecule exactly? They wouldn't have stood a chance. And if it were written in today's scientific terminology, within 20 years it would probably be out of date. So instead you have something absolutely brilliant, it seems to me, a story about a man and a woman and a garden from which all kinds of major truths emerge. That this world was created by God, that it was created good, that human beings have a special place in it, that human beings have messed up the whole thing. And all kinds of massive theological truths flow from this very simple story, which can be understood by anybody in any culture, whether it's a scientific culture or not. And I think that's the important thing. Not whether it's scientifically, literally true, but what God is saying through it. And I wanted to say a bit more about genetics and about the whole emergence of psychology and the study of the mind and the way the brain functions and so on and so forth. Let's just say that if you want to read about any of that stuff, there are plenty of books written by Christians who are skilled in those areas, people who are real world leaders of research in those areas, which will give you nothing to worry about. For example, over the last few years, there's been a lot of talk about the idea that scientists have discovered God inside the human brain, that there are certain centres of your brain which, when stimulated, produce a religious experience. And one scientist even came up with a God helmet, which you put onto your head, and it's supposed to stimulate those parts of your brain, and you start feeling that you have a presence that's there with you. You start feeling more kind and loving towards other human beings. Richard Dawkins put it on and was very disappointed to find it made no difference to him whatsoever. Is this disproving God? Is this showing that God is just part of our brain? Well, you look at what the scientists who are discovering this kind of stuff and working with it are saying. Susan Greenwood in Britain, for instance, is not a believer, but her husband is. And she says, you know, nothing I have found would necessarily take away from the faith in God that my husband and many other people have got. All we're doing is exploring how this thing works, not whether there is somebody behind it. And the Indian, who is one of the leaders in this field, whose name I cannot remember, says, perhaps there are these centres in the brain which produce religious experiences, but perhaps they are just the antennae which God, our Creator, has planted there as a way of our contacting Him. Perhaps it's all part of His creation. It by no means rules out God. Well, there are wild and whirling theories going around, but God remains intact at the heart of the whole thing. Let's move on to the final question, because we've got no time to talk about all of this stuff tonight, and in any case, we have another week at this. And we'll have our interview and a chance to ask questions, and resources will be recommended and all that sort of thing. Does science push people away from Christian faith? No, it doesn't. There's an interesting bit of Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, where he tries to prove, using statistics, that when you are trained as a scientist, you are more likely to drop away from religious belief than otherwise. That, I think, is pretty sketchily and badly done. It doesn't prove the thing at all. And in fact, there's another book by Roger Forster and Paul Marston called Reason, Science and Faith, which is a chapter which goes much more deeply into the same topic than Dawkins does and comes up with precisely opposite conclusions, as most of the surveys carried out over the years in this area have done. No, scientific training does not hasten a decline in religious belief. And you just need to look at some of the faces I've put up here, three names completely at random, really, to see that that's the case. The one on the left there is 19th century scientist James Clerk Maxwell. I walked past the front of his house in Cheyne Walk in Chelsea this summer and saw the very railings where he carried out his magnetic experiments, electromagnetic experiments, to the great displeasure of the neighbours. And he was one of the most brilliant scientific minds of the 19th century. Albert Einstein said, without Maxwell, modern physics would not have emerged. He was a Christian. But you try finding that fact in the Encyclopedia Britannica or any of the standard online biographies of Maxwell. You won't find it. It's been left out. But his Christian faith was what fueled his science and drove his life. Are we just talking about scientists of the past? Well, you could certainly find loads and loads of believing scientists in the past. In fact, possibly the majority of people responsible for the scientific breakthroughs of the last 300 years have had a Christian faith. But does it still happen nowadays? Well, in the middle there, you've got John Polkinghorne, theoretical physicist who has combined being one of the leading lights in world physics with being an Anglican clergyman and the head of a Cambridge college. And Polkinghorne's faith has not been dented by anything he's studied in science whatsoever. On the right, well, you've got Francis Collins, the man who I quoted at the start. And Collins was for a while perhaps the most influential and well-known scientist in the world because he headed up the Human Genome Project, the biggest scientific project of the ages, into which the governments of the world put more money than almost anything else. One which has had revolutionary, world-shattering impacts on our understanding of ourselves. And Collins is somebody who grew up in an atheist family, was sent to church to play the trumpet because the music was good, but told not to listen to anything that went on there, and didn't, in fact, become a Christian until he was 26 and already a research scientist. And he became a Christian by reading a book by C.S. Lewis that convinced him that there's more than one way of looking at the world. Science is one of them. But science isn't all of the answer. And to think that is nothing buttery. Ontological reductionism. There can be more than one explanation of what's going on around you. And to Collins, to Polkinghorne, to Maxwell last century, to many, many other scientists around the world, that second explanation, God, the foolishness of what we believe, is vitally important.